guess it's on now, right? Okay. So our problem was the balance and the variability of brain-coordinated activity in health and disease. The general hypothesis is that we measure electromagnetic signals coming from the brain, and there are different patterns that should emerge when the patient is healthy or when he has some kind of condition. So here you have the neurons of a developing child with autism. Okay, so we applied various techniques to this problem. The first thing we did is we did a statistical analysis of the channel time series. So in some time series we had, in some cases we had 19 channels of time series. In some we had 144, and in one case we had 16. We also developed a mathematical model of the spatiotemporal features of this problem. So the first thing we did, and this is part of our exploratory data analysis, we did singular value decomposition. We did it both on the time series matrix itself and on the covariance matrix of the data, in which case it was PCA. But the same ideas emerged, is that there are a few factors that seem to be overwhelming and to explain a lot of the variability. But we don't know which ones they are, and this is for further analysis. The other question is, are the time series correlated? So we looked at a few metrics, cross variance and cross correlation. And the mathematical definitions are up there. And we computed the correlation coefficients and checked for their statistical significance. We also did, so this is the same idea, but in the frequency domain. The first two metrics are in the time domain. Cross-spectral density, so you can think of that as cross-variance in the frequency domain, and mean squared coherence as cross-correlation in the frequency domain. Okay, so the first thing we did when we got our hands dirty actually trying to look at the data is we took two samples which were provided to us. One sample had six healthy kids, and one sample had seven kids with traumatic brain injury. And we tried to compare the variability in each category. So how strong was the cross-correlation in sample one and in sample two? And we would expect that the healthy sample would have a lot more variability in the cross-correlation. Unfortunately, it didn't look that different. I mean, the mean correlation between channels for the normal children was 14%, and for the traumatic brain injury was 17%. And I didn't put the standard deviations there because standard deviation is greater than me. But that doesn't mean much. It just means that we picked bad samples. I also noticed that as I was doing this, if I took subsets, if I took two of one and two of the other randomly, these numbers changed. I got variations. At one point, I can't remember which ones I had, but I had 10% and 20%. So that's why I say it was variable over the subsets. Then we looked at correlations and cross correlations of channels using MATLAB's functions. And the results showed us some interesting trends. So what I'll show you, we used MATLAB's pcolor function to color the matrices, the correlation matrices, to give us some visual representation. So this is on the left you have the correlation between channels, and on the right you have the cross correlation between channels. It's a very subtle difference. One of them has sliding windows, the other one doesn't. But the same patterns emerge. So the warmer the color means the higher the correlation. So we have a cluster here at the bottom left in each matrix that shows us that that's where the correlations occur, the strong correlations occur. And naturally, along the diagonal, you have one. So that's why it's all red along the diagonal. Repeating this experiment, but using different time windows, we noticed that the time window that you look at is very important. So a 5-minute window, and then that same window, if you take the first quarter, you get very different patterns. So food for thought, that's part of our exploratory data analysis process. Then we looked in the frequency domain in our exploratory analysis. We looked. We wanted to look at the distribution of energy content in across channels, in each channel. And here, correct me if I'm wrong, you have two different channels, and you see how the distribution occurs, and it's not the same. And then we wanted to see that. Right? Can you explain what this is, Natalie? No, this one. In each channel, yes. And a cluster around 29. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Then the other thing we did is we looked at, again, we were comparing channels and different ways to do the same thing, different ways to look at the same thing. What you have on the left is the dots represent a statistically significant correlation between channel I and channel J. So you see some places don't have dots, but most of them are statistically significant. And then on the right, you have the cross-spectral density between channels, and you see that where you have the spikes means that at that frequency there was a high correlation between those two channels. So you see that the spikes occur at different places, like here and here, and they're kind of clustered in the center. Probably can't see the scale. We also did windowing and compared on different windows because these things, as you said, vary across time. So we selected different subintervals and computed correlation over time and compared all windows. So here I will show you a little movie to see how these things evolved over time. So let me start at the beginning. So this is what you saw earlier, but this will show you the evolution over time. So you see that they're not constant across time. So a little animation. So that's the data frame. Now we did the same thing in with the hyperventilation data set where we had a child where they simulated hyperventilation, and you see the evolution. And can you? Thank you. end of the experiment. Now I really want to talk about the spatial temporal model.
Right. So while I'm setting up, this was a fun problem to work on because, in some sense, we got to define what we wanted to work on. So as Peter described, the key question was, are different parts of your brain sending out electrical signals which are correlated? And so if they are, what does this mean? And if they're not, is that an indication of health or not? So we did a lot of statistics, but then I'm not a statistician, and so I thought, okay, we've got to do some actual physics here to try and understand a mechanism. So I learned a key distinction between idealized math models and practice. So we are not giant squids. So I cannot model the neuron by Hodgkin-Huxley and then hope to upscale, because the human brain has many, many, many neurons. So what we went to was this work by Lali Kadouche and his colleagues in 2001, in which what they do is they take a collection of neurons, and they say that modeling each neuron accurately is a hopeless endeavor because the brain is just too neuron rich. However, you can try and upscale, come up with a mean field model to describe cortical activity somewhat spatially aggregated. So what this means is that all the neurons that are within, say, 1 millimeter squared are aggregated to one model neuron, and then you have a bunch of such neurons across the brain. And so they had a spatiotemporal model, which was it's a collection of PDEs which describe postsynaptic currents, postsynaptic activity, and firing. They are able to compute membrane potentials, and these are the things that are actually measured. So you can actually stick an electrode on and measure something that correlates well to membrane potential. As with any model, this had gazillions of parameters, which they were able to fit to normal physiological data. So it was actually a pretty good model, except that it's hugely complicated. So we didn't want to work with this. So then I will confess that copious amounts of beer went into this modeling effort. And thanks to Greg and a moment of inebriation, I learned about his colleague, Leonard. So Leonard collaborated with Lily and simplified the complex PDE model into what happens for one of these spatially aggregated neurons. So remember, this is not a single neuron. This is a collection of neurons that are talking together at the scale of, say, 1 millimeter squared. But rather than model each of these neurons in a network model, he has a spatial averaging, which allows him to simplify considerably what you might get otherwise. And so you get ODE models for the synaptic activities and the potentials. And remember, this is important because we can actually measure potentials. So there are several variables, but the prototypical equations look like I've got up here. So this is the ODE, which is satisfied by the excitatory membrane potential H sub E, and this depends on the synaptic activity. So there's interaction between excitatory and excitatory neurons, excitatory and inhibitory neurons, etc. So there's activity between inhibitory I and excitatory E, etc. So there's four possible activities. You model all four, gives you a total of six equations, which are ODEs. And the important term in here for what I propose to do next is P. Sorry? This is what they had in their paper, I promise. Okay, so this was one neuron, and this has been done, right? And so Huashong and I had dinner, and this is where we were at dinner time. And so we were determined that we were going to get something mathematical to happen, and so the idea was we would take two of these neurons, and we would connect them. So we would have two of these spatially averaged neurons, and we would have them coupled by different mechanisms. And then we would have some parameters to play with, so perhaps a synaptic activity from one affects the other neuron, depending on how far apart they are. Okay. That's what I did. So this is just a sanity check. This is a single neuron. So on top I have the membrane potential. So the curve in red is the excitatory membrane potential. The curve in blue is the inhibitory membrane potential. And so you can see this nice pattern of firing. So ignore the first few seconds to relax, or the first few milliseconds to relax into the state, and then you can see this predictable behavior. Here are the activities. They also fire. So it's very nice. I don't have to tweak anything in the model. So what kinds of coupling did we try? Well, remember, this is 9 o'clock last night. So we tried to assume that both the neurons are identical and that they experience the same interaction terms. So the synaptic activity from one is scaled and added into the synaptic activity term for the other, and vice versa. But otherwise, the neighborhoods are exactly the same. Their parameter values are exactly the same. The next kind of coupling we tried, this is 9:30 p.m., was that the neurons are not identical and that they experience a different immediate neighborhood. So some of their parameter values are different. Okay. And then at 10:15, these neurons are talking to each other, but it takes a finite time for synaptic activity information to go from one spot to the other. Remember, they're going across lengths of, say, a centimeter or two or three. Okay, so if there are identical coupled neurons, then the P from one influences the activity in the other, and vice versa. If I said that the levels of inhibitory and excitatory interactions scale differently in the neurons, then you see this is what's happening in one neuron, that's what's happening in the other neuron. These two time series seem to be lagged a little bit. Okay. But otherwise, if you eyeball this, they look pretty similar. So what's going on in one neuron is very similar to what's going on in the other neuron, maybe lagged a little bit. In this one, I've set everything else to be the same, and I've put these neurons really far apart. And so you can see that because they're identical neurons, they're doing the identical same thing. So if I change the local neighborhood of these neurons, so if I said one neuron is slightly different from the other and they're cross-talking, then the membrane potential in the one is affected by the other, but they're not exactly the same. However, they are correlated. So these two time series, if you look at their cross-sectional density, then you can see that there is a strong correlation at about, well, this would be about 5 hertz or 3 hertz, and eyeballing this would be about 10 or 12 hertz. And if we put in a delay term, so we said that the membrane potential in one neuron affects the firing in another one, but with a time lag in there, and we model the time lag as a distributed delay, then we get a completely different looking behavior. Same starting point, same other parameters, except the distributed delay. So the membrane potentials now seem to settle down very quickly into their resting states, and their correlation looks very, very different. Now, of course, this was garbage because I didn't know what parameters to pick. It was 10:30, and we were going to quit at 10:30. However, the point here is that this is a possible avenue of exploration which is of interest, because there is this data that says here's one channel, here's another channel. We know the distance between the channels. We could actually try to fit this model to that data in the case of a normal person or several normal people. All right, so to summarize what our group did, we did a lot of statistics. We did some math modeling. What we really cool is to try and determine physically reasonable parameter values for these two neuron coupling models. But an even better thing to do would be to actually simulate the whole PDE. That PDE exists, it's got parameter values which are actually fitted to normal people. They've had some success in predicting behavior in anesthetized patients. It'd be interesting to compare that. It'd be interesting to find parameter values in that model which simulate things like autism or being drunk or whatever. What we have not achieved, or what we would like to achieve but didn't have time to, is to assess different measures of statistical correlation between these time series to see which ones are good predictors. Because it's fine to say that this measure says these two things are correlated, but does that have any diagnostic power? Does it have sensitivity? Does it have specificity? These are things we should investigate, but since all these measures are inexpensive to compute, this is something that can be done. Feature selection to figure out which are the important channels to look at would be useful. So there is gobloads of data, and not all the data is equally important. Some data is more important than others. What is the important data? And I think there is, while there is value to the meta-analysis, which is what the problem consisted of, we learned that different conditions manifest themselves with different physiological behaviors, so it's not clear to me that the same statistical measure will work equally well across all disorders. So, yep, I'd like to thank our team that worked very, very hard, and I'd like to thank Vera and Adam and Luis and Jose and, yeah. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you. And Peter will take questions.
Is that good? Great. Thanks.